The husband. You think you admire moral qualities, but when you fall in love, you revert to the primitive, where the physical is all that counts. From The Mon in the Brown Suit by Agatha Christie. She lifted up her eyes and loved him, with that love which was her doom. From The Ideals of the King by Alfred Lord Tennyson. Ugbrook House, near Exeter, is one of the great Devon mansions, a house of mythic beauty. By daylight, its stone is rose pink. At night, it is ethereal and shadowy. It was here, on the 12th of October 1912, that Agatha Miller first met Archie Christie, when he strode up and asked for three dances on her card. After two of these, he asked for three more. Agatha's card was full, but she gave in when Archie told her to cut the other partners, showing what was for her an unusual disregard for the conventions. Archie was 23, almost exactly a year older than Agatha. He had a decided manner, an air of being able to get his own way always. He was long, lean, intense, and he had that mysterious quality of romance before which women are helpless. He had fallen too, though. He had no money with which to set up a home and no short-term prospects, but he determined from the first to possess Agatha. At the time of their meeting, he was a second lieutenant in the Royal Field Artillery, ambitious for advancement. He had decided upon the means, a career as a pilot. His clear brain, whose practicality was so alien to Agatha that she found it romantically compelling, saw aeroplanes not as something magical, but as an inevitable future in which he could play a part. He had therefore paid £75 for flying lessons on Salisbury Plain, and 3 months before he met Agatha, became the 245th qualified aviator in Britain. All of this he wrote in the notebook that logged the important facts of his life. Archie liked to organize his memories in this way. 16th of July. Got Royal Aero Club certificate on a Bristol box kite after being at the school about a month on leave from Exeter. Applied to join the Royal Flying Corps and went back to Exeter. Archie was one of several members of the Exeter garrison invited to the dance at Ugbrook by its owners, Lord and Lady Clifford of Chudley. Agatha had been asked by friends of the Cliffords. She had intended to meet there another soldier, Arthur Griffiths, with whom she had had a light flirtation at Thorpe Arch Hall. He was unable to attend, but wrote to her suggesting that she look out for his friend Christie, who was a good dancer and might amuse her. 12th of October. Went to dance at Lord Clifford of Chudley's, wrote Archie in his notebook. And not long after his night amid the pink stone arches and moonlit balconies, he chugged up Barton Road on his motorbike. He took tea with Clara. He waited. Across the road at Rookland's, Agatha played badminton with the son of the house, also smitten with her. The last entirely carefree moments of her life were spent practicing dance steps. We were, I think, tangoing. Then her mother telephoned to summon her home. She was reluctant to come. One of your young men, Clara had said, not having caught the name properly. And however much Agatha had dreamed of seeing Archie Christie again, but how, in those days, she did not for a moment think it was he who might be waiting for her. Such an effort he had made to find her. He stood when she entered the drawing room and gave his embarrassed story about having been in the neighbourhood. He stayed to supper. The two saw each other several times afterwards in quick succession, exquisitely, increasingly frustrated by the customs of the time. Archie asked Agatha to a concert in Exeter, followed by tea. Clara informed him that Agatha could not take tea in a hotel with a man, so he invited Clara to come too. She relented to the extent of allowing him to give tea to her daughter, alone, at Exeter railway station. Agatha asked Archie to the New Year ball at the start of 1913, at which he was completely silent. 2 days later, on the 4th of January, Archie's log records that he went to Ashfield, Torquay, and concert at the Pavilion. The music that night was Agatha's beloved Wagner. The Pavilion was then newly completed, a fresh white and green building on the seafront. She and Archie sat beside each other beneath its domed skylight, their sleeves touching, listening to the music. Afterwards, they went upstairs to the schoolroom at home, as Agatha put it in her autobiography, to play the piano. Then Archie turned to her with sudden fierceness and said, "You've got to marry me. You've got to marry me." She was surely not surprised, despite her superficial bemusement. He had known, he told her, from the night of the dance at Uggbrook. He was leaving in 2 days' time to start his training at Salisbury Plain with the Royal Flying Corps, and he needed to be sure of Agatha first. She stalled, but the next day she spoke to Clara. "I'm sorry, Mother. I've got to tell you. Archie Christie has asked me to marry him, and I want to. I want to dreadfully." The wedding would not take place for almost 2 years, and its delays and cancellations, due to Clara's opposition, lack of money, the outbreak of war, look in retrospect like so many signs that it should never have happened. Yet the urge for it grew ever stronger in both parties. Every time one broke it off, the subsequent reunion was sweeter. So dependency grew, and the belief that here was love forever. At the time of the proposal, Agatha was engaged to another man, an obstacle that Archie dismissed as a housemaid might swat a fly. She had received several offers of marriage from her late teens onwards. Her sweet, serene, assured femininity made her extremely attractive to men, both sexually and as wife material. "You are very lovely, however ruffled your hair is, and have the most perfect nature I can imagine," Archie wrote to Agatha in 1914, and this was how many saw her. Later, she would tell her second husband that she had no gift for men. "I shall never have the proper Olympian attitude towards the male sex," she wrote in 1930. But as a girl, before her life changed so completely, hers was an entirely natural female instinct. Like Nell Vereker in Giant's Bread, she had a pleasure in herself that was both innocent and knowing. Agatha liked men very much, preferred them to women on the whole, and she showed this in a way that they liked. Her first two proposals came from men she had met in Cairo. One made his approach through her mother. "You know Captain Hibbard wanted to marry you, I suppose," Clara told Agatha as they were sailing home. She had refused him on her daughter's behalf, a presumption to which even Agatha objected. "I really do think, Mother, that you might let me have my own proposals." Clara agreed, but she still hoped, to an extent, to control events. There were three other proposals before Archie that counted for something. The first was from a man she met in around 1911 while she was staying in Warwickshire with the Ralston Patricks, great hunting people, who, most unusually for this time, owned a car. Agatha first became aware of cars at the end of the 19th century when visiting Paris with her parents. "Monty would love them," Clara had said. She was sitting side saddle on her mount when a man about 35, a colonel named Bolton Fletcher, was introduced to her. That evening, she appeared at a fancy dress party as Elaine, Tennyson's Lily Maid of Astolat, wearing a white dress and a pearl cap. It was a costume to suit her princesse lointaine allure, and it certainly aroused a chivalric knight in Fletcher, who went straight into action. He pursued Agatha as hard as Archie did later, although with a good deal more money and experience at his command. He sent extravagant presents and wonderful love letters. Technically, he knew a great deal about women, was her judgment upon a similar type of man in a Westmacott novel, A Daughter's a Daughter. Fletcher called Agatha the perfect Elaine, and this was the way she liked to see herself. Sitting high in her chamber, as Tennyson wrote, combing her long pale hair, dreaming of Lancelot. She was flattered, she was enjoying herself, she wondered if perhaps this was love. In fact, she went a fair way to being overwhelmed. When, in a distant echo of modern sexual mores, Fletcher proposed to her on their third meeting, she felt enveloped in a storm of emotion. It had nothing really to do with the man himself, everything to do with his expertise. "When you say you don't feel anything for me," he said softly, "you're a liar." Agatha was filled with an excitement she did not understand, and was confused and tempted. So too was Clara. Part of her liked the idea of an older husband for her daughter, a man of the world, who knew how to treat women, and who, above all, was rich. "I've been praying so, that a good man would come along and give you a good home and make you happy. There's so little money," she said, in Unfinished Portrait. But she understood Agatha's bewildered resistance, and another part of her was relieved by it. She told Fletcher to wait 6 months. When, at the end of that time, he sent a telegram demanding a firm answer to his proposal, Agatha found herself writing, "No," then falling asleep, like a tired little girl. She never regretted turning down Bilton Fletcher, although later she played with the idea that the marriage might have worked. In her detective novel, Three-Act Tragedy, she has the young egg, Lytton Gore, in love with a much older man. Girls were always attracted to middle-aged men with interesting pasts. The relationship is all about hero worship on one side, youth worship on the other, but this does not mean it would be more difficult to sustain than a marriage between apparent equals, or one that is apparently without illusions. "Lady Mary, you wouldn't like your girl to marry a man twice her own age," a character says to Egg's mother. Her answer surprised him. "It might be safer so. At that age, a man's follies and sins are definitely behind him. They are not still to come." There was neither folly nor sin in Wilfred Pirrie, with whom Agatha was next entangled. He was merely a terrible bore, young and intensely solemn about life, as she wrote of Jim, his fictional representation in Unfinished Portrait, and very strong on willpower. He had books about it which he lent to Celia. He was very fond of lending books. He was also interested in theosophy, bimetallism, economics, and Christian Science. He liked Celia because she listened so attentively. She read all the books and made intelligent comments on them. As a girl, Agatha had sought to please, with her answers in the album of confessions, her desire to be surrounded by babies, her dislike of affectation and vulgarity. Now, in agreeing to marry Wilfred, she was doing the same thing. All her life she believed in duty. She had a problem to solve, the problem of her own future conduct, and perhaps strangely, it presented itself to her as a question of duty. It was a function of upbringing, of generation. But the complexity of Agatha's nature meant that pleasing other people was also, more perversely, a means of inner escape. If she did what was wanted, what was expected, who knew what mysterious thoughts she might hide behind the facade? She did not take Wilfred seriously as a man. Kissing him was deadly dull, and her grandmother, the magnificent Margaret, despised his non-drinking, non-smoking, theosophical ways. He was very polite, very formal, and, to her mind, intensely boring. The thought flashed across her brain, "Better stuff in our young days." But he presented to her a future both safe and oddly liberating. His family, the Pinks, were old friends of the Millers. His mother and Agatha had adored each other for years. Moreover, Wilfred was a sub-lieutenant in the Royal Navy, which meant that when he was away, Agatha could live at Ashfield. In fact, she need hardly leave home. her relationship with Clara would be almost unchanged. A daughter's a daughter all your life, as Agatha wrote in her Mary Westmacott novel. This was what Clara wanted, for Agatha to move into the world of adulthood, but to remain her child. And Agatha wanted it too, almost completely. So Clara was desperate for the marriage to take place, and Agatha was desperate to make her happy. But the day came when she knew she could not do it. The real reason lay buried in her poetic ideas of love and fulfillment, the dark yearnings for the stranger knight who would invade her life and take her beyond herself. The ostensible reason arose when Wilfred telephoned Agatha to say that he had been invited to join a party leaving for South America to look for treasure trove, and would she mind very much if he went. He was desperate to go, not least because the two mediums he visited regularly in Portsmouth had told him he should. They had said that undoubtedly he would come back having discovered a city that had not been known since the time of the Incas. Agatha might have been thought to take this kind of thing seriously. Her early stories were full of ghosts, phenomena, premonitions. The House of Beauty, with its vision of a wonderful house, in which dwelt the shadow of an unclean thing. The Call of Wings, in which music lifts the body free of its shackles. But the supernatural was a means for Agatha to express her sense of the ineffable. It was never something believable in itself. Her mother took such things extremely seriously, which meant that Agatha tried to do so. She had also read Edgar Allan Poe and May Sinclair, and was, to an extent, influenced by them. Yet there was a robust side of Agatha, Martha Miller's granddaughter, after all, that thought it utter nonsense. Unlike Clara, she was not mystical. The supernatural was entirely separate from the dreams and secrets that haunted her imagination. She saw its power, though, and used it in her writings, increasingly against itself. As a young girl, she had written what was called a grisly story about a séance. Later, she turned this into the detective novel The Sitterford Mystery, which is written with an apparent belief in Ouija boards and table-turning, but is, in fact, creating an atmospheric smokescreen. The séance has been engineered for the most base and practical of reasons, as an alibi for one of the people attending it, and more fool any reader who took it seriously. The Agatha who could write this, or The Pale Horse, or Dumb Witness, or the short story Motive versus Opportunity, all of which take the skeptic's view, would have found Wilfred Pixie irredeemably silly. The day he left for South America is described in Unfinished Portrait. How beautiful an August morning can be. Never, Celia thought, had she felt so happy. The old familiar pain clutched at her. It was so lovely it hurt. Oh, beautiful, beautiful world. You look very happy, Celia.
I am happy. It's such a lovely day.
Her mother said quietly, It's not only that. It's because Jim's gone away, isn't it? This, though, is more than just the blessed relief at no longer having to pretend an interest in theosophy. These are the emotions of a girl who loved freedom more intensely than most girls did, who perceived a life beyond the known limits, in which marriage did not bring the greatest happiness, whose most intense pleasures came not from fulfillment, completion, or knowledge, but from the feelings that hover around the edge of these things. The moment of Archie standing to greet her in the drawing room at Ashfield, the memory of Archie holding her dance card and pointing carelessly at three names. Cut this one, this one. The thought of Archie on his motorbike, climbing the hill she walked every day, looking intently for Ashfield. Those were sweet in a way that no realization could ever be.
I don't really want to marry anyone yet.
Darling, how right you are. It's never quite the same afterwards, is it? Yet Agatha did want marriage, nothing more, and so she accepted the proposal of Reggie Lucy. A major in the Gunners, He was elder brother to the girls with whom she had long been close, if casual, friends. "We've thought Reggie had his eye on you for some time, Aggie." And he shared their easy engagement with life. If one missed a train, what did it matter? Another would come along. How pointless, then, to worry. If one was useless at golf, as Agatha was, despite Reggie's best efforts to improve her game on the course at Torquay, so what? She could still enjoy herself swinging a club. Agatha was mesmerized by this attitude, which was not her own, and she felt comfortable with Reggie in a way that did not entirely preclude sexual attraction. They would talk together, fall silent, talk again. "The way I most like holding a conversation." She liked his proposal, too. "You've got a lot of scalps, haven't you, Agatha? Well, you can put mine with them any time you like." It was an idiom with which she was at home, and her mother sensed that here was the right man. "I think this will be a happy marriage," she said. Then, "I wish he'd told you a little earlier, so you could have married straight away." As usual, Clara had gone to the heart of things. Reggie had proposed to Agatha during 10 days' leave, after which he knew he would not return to Devon for some time. 2 years, as it happened. He insisted that she should, throughout that time, consider herself free. It was an attitude with which, again, she was comfortable, so unlike the disturbing persistence of Bolton Fletcher, but which left her annoyed. Should a man not be more assertive, more jealous, and a little scared? It was as if she knew that somebody else would come along, that she would choose the unknown man over Reggie, and that this would be the wrong thing to do. Hercule Poirot said softly, "Can you not accept facts? She loved Roderick Wellman. What of it? With you she can be happy." In Unfinished Portrait, Agatha thought a good deal about Reggie, or Peter, as she called him. She considered the results of his folly in not marrying her instantly, as she had begged him to do. Women often think about men of their youth, wondering if they have let go the one with whom they would have been happiest. But Agatha did, in this case, have cause. Why did Reggie back off? Because of his nature. He had the Lucy trait of laissez-aller, and in his decent humility, he felt he did not have the right to keep Agatha from other offers. Hence the letter Peter writes when Celia tells him she is going to marry Dermot, as Archie Christie is called. It was exactly like Peter, so like Peter that Celia cried over it. "Don't blame yourself, Celia. It was my fault entirely. The truth of it is, you feel he's got more guts than I had. I ought to have taken you at your word when you wanted to marry me. He's a better man than I am. Your Dermot." Agatha did not think Archie was a better man than Reggie. In her early letters to her second husband, written not long before Unfinished Portrait, she thanked him over and over again for his kindness, the quality in which Reggie had been abundant and Archie was not. "Not considerate," Clara said of him, "ruthless." Nor did he have any money, which caused the one moment of bitterness in Peter's letter. "And now you've fallen in love with someone poorer than I am." Archie had £80 a year and no prospects of family inheritance. Agatha's £100 annuity, meanwhile, was to be given up to Clara. Chaplin's in New York, of which Frederick's father had been a partner, had finally collapsed in 1913, taking with it Clara's tiny income. Margaret Miller had moved her money out some time earlier. Mr. Chaplin himself guaranteed Clara £300 a year from his personal fortune, and with help from Agatha and Madge, this would allow her to stay at Ashfield. By now, Clara was determined to keep her home, which she saw as a magical protection against change. Of course, Agatha wanted to give her money in support of Ashfield, but she was in a difficult position. Without her income, marriage to Archie seemed impossible. "I told Archie that I could never marry him, that we should have to forget each other," she wrote in her autobiography. Archie refused to listen to this. Somehow or other, he was going to make money. We could get married, and he might even be able to help support my mother. He made me confident and hopeful. We got engaged again. On other occasions, it would be Archie who said that marriage was impossible, and Agatha who talked him round. Clara, though, was consistently against the idea. There was not enough money, she said, and that was that. In fact, her misgivings went deeper. But this was her best argument, the hardest for Archie to counter. Although the two maintained a wary cordiality, Clara remained obdurate. Leaving aside her more complex emotions, it must have frustrated her to see Agatha reject a procession of eligible men in favour of this penniless pilot. Marriage was the conventional route, but Archie was by no means a conventional choice. Madge, for all her daring, had played it infinitely safer when she accepted James Watts, and there would have been far less risk attached to rich Bolton Fletcher, stolid Wilfred Pixie, or kindly Reggie Lucy. Life in the RFC, while it held prospects for promotion, was almost ludicrously precarious. There was also a more subtle point. The Pixies and Lucys were family friends. Fletcher was a friend of friends. The Christies were not known to the Millers, and had it not been for his soldiering career, Archie would have been unlikely to come into Agatha's orbit. She was, in fact, of a slightly higher social class. Clara, who had similarly married above herself, may well have pondered the outcome of a meeting between her late husband, the refined Frederick, and Archie's Irish mother, Ellen, known as Peg. Peg had made a good marriage to a judge in the Indian Civil Service. Archie was born in Muree. But when her husband died after a fall from his horse, she had settled in England, where life was not easy. At the turn of the century, while the Millers were living with their servants at Ashfield, Peg was lodging with Campbell, Archie's brother, in a house in Bristol. Archie was at prep school in Godalming. She was good-looking, as were her sons, and later married a man named William Helmsley, who proved her saviour. He was kind, solid, and, most usefully, a schoolmaster at Clifton College, where Archie later became head of school. But this was some distance from the world of the Union Club on New York's Fifth Avenue, in which Frederick had been so very much at home. Of course, Archie was wholly gentlemanly. There is no doubt, though, that Agatha was thrown by Peg's manner, a mixture of gush, dislike, and jealousy. It was ironic that Campbell Christie should have warned Agatha that his mother was dangerous, an identical judgment to the one that her granddaughter later made about Clara. There were indeed similarities between the two women. Peg was as possessive a mother as Clara, and equally, though not consistently, opposed to the marriage. The difference, which in Agatha's eyes was the fundamental difference between a lady and a non-lady, a distinction she never shied from making, was that Clara could hide her feelings. Peg hid nothing. This, for Agatha, was an entirely new experience. She had seen her mother lose control briefly after Frederick's death, but decorum had been restored as a matter of principle, and all her life Agatha would value the ability to maintain a facade. "I remember my dear mother telling me that a gentlewoman should always be able to control herself in public, however much she may give way in private," was how Miss Marple put it. Archie paid no attention whatever to his mother and her oddities. "True to temperament," wrote Agatha in her autobiography, "he was not particularly interested in what she thought of me or I of her. He had the happy attitude of going through life without the least interest in what anyone thought of him or his belongings. His mind was always entirely bent on what he wanted himself." Which in 1913 was Agatha. This beautiful and mysterious man wanted her so badly that he demanded they marry instantly, without waiting, and without seeking to please anybody but themselves. To Agatha, it was fate, her female destiny. Having been brought up to express herself in any way she chose, she expected only to marry. This was her upbringing, which she had no urge to question. Girls of her sort did not have careers, they had husbands. Her father had been horrified by the thought of his lovely, lively Madge among the earnest blue stockings of Girton, and his wife did not disagree with him. The care with which she had had to tread through her own early life had left her in some ways deeply conventional. She wanted happiness for her daughters, and to her that meant marriage. Agatha believed this too, or so she believed. In Evil Under the Sun, Poirot discusses the question with the successful clothes designer Rosamund Darnley. "To marry and have children, that is the common lot of women. Only one woman in 100, more in 1,000, can make for herself a name and a position as you have done." Rosamund grinned at him. "And yet, all the same, I'm nothing but a wretched old maid." The book ends with Rosamund blissfully abandoning her business for love. And Agatha, despite her extraordinary achievements, would always assert that a career was a man's job. "Men have much better brains than women, don't you think?" was a typical comment. And that the true value of a woman lay within the personal arena. "It makes me feel that, after all, I have not been a failure in life, that I have succeeded as a wife," she wrote to her second husband, Max, in 1943. So as a girl, she never chafed against the limits of her life, the conventions, the corsets, the need to speak low or to sing to a teddy bear. Unlike her near-contemporary Dorothy L. Sayers, who, at the time of Agatha's entry into the marriage market, was chewing the intellectual fat over coffee at Somerville, she had no desire to break free. She felt free anyway. Her imagination was infinite. Her creative fires burned within a brazier of contentment. There was nothing of the Shavian new woman in Agatha, striding towards a future of sexual equality. For all that she loved the novels of May Sinclair, she shared none of her feminist concerns. The frustrations of a girl like Vera Brittain, then at Oxford with Sayers, whose Testament of Youth rages against the male-dominated conventions of the time, would have been utterly remote to her. The truth is that she liked a man's world. She saw beyond it, although not in a political sense. Later she would live beyond it with her success and self-sufficiency, yet she loved being female, and never felt circumscribed by her sex. She had grown up in a matriarchy, after all, and she understood, as cleverer girls perhaps do not, that female strength could show itself in many different ways, that a Margaret Miller, indomitable within her well-run menage, had at least as much power as a woman in the public sphere. She also knew that women need not appear strong in order to be so. The fragile little Mrs. Franklin in Curtin is despised for her wiles by the grave young scientist Judith. "She's a very stupid woman," says Judith. But Poirot wisely replies, "She uses her grey cells in ways that you, my child, know nothing about." Agatha never despised femininity, even in its most foolish form, although sometimes she pitied it. All her life she valued what she had had, beauty, attraction, natural physical allure, and then lost. "What's the good of a woman like that?" asks a character in Dead Men's Folly of the gorgeous, empty-headed Lady Stubbs. Again, Poirot defends her. "One needs roots as well as flowers on a plant." Agatha always defended the right to leisure. "Without it, where are you?" And held that sensible women knew when they were well off, controlling the home with an authoritative finger and their men with a compliant smile. But it was a profound contradiction in her that she put so high a value on doing nothing, yet became so compulsively industrious. In fact, she had a deep regard for working women. Not the strident ones who waved the feminist flag like the politician Lady Westhome in Appointment with Death, proclaiming that, "If anything is to be accomplished, mark my words, it is women who will do it." No, Agatha admired the servants like Jane the cook, producing 5-course dinners without turning a hair. The poor girls like Midge in the Hollow, battling through the days in her terrible dress shop. The impoverished ladies like Miss Carnaby, the paid companion in the labours of Hercules. I'm not a clever woman at all, and I've no training and I'm getting older, and I'm so terrified for the future. The women who pursued a vocation, teachers in particular. As Dorothy L. Sayers made clear in her Oxford novel Gaudy Night, this tended to be a celibate life, which made it alien to Agatha. But she always portrayed it as worthy of absolute respect. Miss Williams' life had been interesting to her, she wrote of the governess in Five Little Pigs. She had that enormous mental and moral advantage of a strict Victorian upbringing. She had done her duty in that station of life to which it had pleased God to call her, and that assurance encased her in an armour impregnable to the slings and darts of envy, discontent, and regret. Later came the headmistress, Miss Bulstrode, in Cat Among the Pigeons, full of cosmopolitan aplomb, who, when murder comes to her school, sits cool and unmoved, with her life work falling in ruins about her. A version of this character appeared in The Third Girl, Halloween Party, and finally as the doomed Miss Temple in Nemesis. A handsome woman, and a woman of personality. Yes, 1,000 pities, Miss Marple thought. 1,000 pities if the world was going to lose Elizabeth Temple. Agatha had not been taught by this kind of woman, but she had known one as a friend. Eileen Morris was a very different type of the charming, carefree Lucys. A natural and unresentful spinster who lived in a big house overlooking the sea with her 5 maiden aunts, she was a few years older than Agatha, but by around 1909 the age difference had ceased to matter, and the two became close. At Greenway House there was a folded copy of one of Eileen's poems, Darnley to the Queen, which has little artistry, but much controlled intelligence. Eileen told Agatha to send her own work to the Poetry Review, to whom she sold the odd thing, including her Commedia dell'Arte poems, for a guinea. Eileen was rather plain, but she had a remarkable mind. Her brother was the schoolmaster, but Eileen herself was the very model of one of Agatha's sharp-brained, distinguished, energetic teachers. She was the first person I had come across with whom I could discuss ideas. Agatha herself had a different type of mind, more fluid and diffuse. Although she held strong opinions, it was her writerly strength to be able to doubt them. Nor did she trust concepts, theories, or ideologies, being always of the opinion that human nature did not fit easily into them. Yet with Eileen she liked to talk about these things. It was perhaps the unaccustomed freedom within their friendship that led to this speech in Agatha's first novel, Snow Upon the Desert. Rosamund Vaughan, who measures her worth solely according to male values, suddenly speaks with a new and wholly honest female voice. It seems to be an accepted idea that every woman will strive to live up to a man's ideal of her, that she will be grateful for his idealization of her. It's not a bit true. One has, if anything, a contempt for people who can't see you as you are. Oh, one gets sick and tired, bored, of being admired by impossible imaginary qualities. I'm not a cross between an angel and a hospital nurse. What respect can I have for the brains of anyone who thinks I am? I've got some good points. Why don't they admire those? Those thoughts had lurked somewhere within the 19-year-old Agatha as she danced in her pink dresses and made dutiful, decorously flirtatious conversation. Somewhere she felt the desire for a different kind of life, a true liberation. But she was too happy, as a young girl, to care about it. She had no urge to be herself in the modern sense. "You are lovely and interesting and sweet to everyone," Archie wrote to her. And this was what she wanted to hear. "You are lovely and perfect in every way." If he thought this because Agatha presented herself to him as an impossible ideal, that was fine by her. She knew he would not have written such things to a girl who looked or expressed herself as Eileen Morris did. Agatha was glad of her superior attractions, her success as a female, however strong the lure of Eileen's superior mind. The irony is that, of the two, it was Agatha who forged the career. This, despite her lack of formal education, her indifference to the notion of sexual equality, her complacent contentment with the status quo. But it was Agatha's very imperviousness to the way she ought to be thinking that, in the end, made her such a surprising and singular talent. Of course, she absorbed, she observed, she listened. She was susceptible to the powerful personalities of her mother, of Madge, of Eileen. Her early writings bear the imprint of what she had been reading, Poe, Sinclair, D.H. Lawrence. I was trying things like one does. Yet in some way she was always proof against outside influence. All her life she would, with only the most occasional exceptions, ignore any suggestions made about her writing. She followed her instincts with a rare certainty. Agatha herself would probably not have understood what she was doing, or why, as a merry young girl leading a life of infinite pleasure, she was at the same time seeking the solitude in which to write stories, poems, and a full-length novel. Why, when deep in love with a young man whom she longed to marry, she was pursuing the ambition of publication. She saw no contradiction in any of this. Women today are tormented by the separation between work and life, between private and social fulfillment, between individuality and biology. It did not occur to Agatha to think in such a way. She had a simplicity that resolved her complexities. But a letter from Eden Philpotts, who had been so generous about Snow Upon the Desert, hinted at the conflicts that might later arise. Agatha had shown him a further story entitled Being So Very Willful, a quotation from the Elaine section of Idylls of the King. The story no longer exists, but Philpotts was impressed by it, so much so that he dignified it with this remarkable reply. All is going exceedingly well with your work, and should life so fall out for you that it has room for art, and if you can face the uphill fight to take your place and win it, you have the gift sufficient. I never prophesy, but I should judge that if you can write like this now, you might go far. However, life knocks the art out of a good many people, and your environment in the time to come may substitute for the hard road of art a different one. The late Mrs. Craigie was about the only woman I know who stuck to hard work for love of it. But then circumstances combined to make her do so.